time, we started talking about Ayinhara, this evil eye concept, and we identified passages within the Torah, within Tanakh, where this shows up. We talked about thinking poorly of somebody else or having a miserly approach to others, not wanting to help them, and even having a desire to harm others. We tied it into Bilam. We talked about the selfishness of Moab. And I think the last thing we did was to view it perhaps as a form of tefillah, a form of prayer, which is a negative. Davening to Hashem and saying, so-and-so should be punished, or why does so-and-so deserve what he has? That was where we finished off last time. What I want to talk about today, and I'm not sure we'll get through all of this today, is number one, the question of, do we take this concern seriously? Is this something that, I don't mean do we as in do people, because we know people say Kanayahara, and some people do that more seriously and some people do it less seriously. But within halacha, is this something that we're supposed to care about? That's number one. Number two, are the, so to speak, anti-evil eye treatments actually acceptable within Judaism? The things that people do in order to avoid Ayin Hara. And this brings us into the realm also of segulos, special practices that people have, which aren't really associated with a particular mitzvah, but just practices that people have that they believe will have a positive impact on their lives. So how do we view those practices, and what's recommended for avoiding Ayin Hara? So that's what I would like to get to. There's actually, it would be interesting also to have sort of a subtopic of, on the general practice of praying to harm somebody else, because that's also interesting. But we have a lot to cover.
People actually do that these days?
I don't know if they do it consciously, but I know that people do it unconsciously, yes.
It's not very nice. They're jealous.
Right. Why did they deserve it? Why did they, you know, why do they have what I don't have? You know, without a doubt, there are people who are suffering, you know, for lack of things or because of actual, you know, things that have happened to them, and they see what the good fortune of others. And, well, why can't I have what so-and-so has?
But that's not saying I wish so-and-so didn't have it and I did.
Right. It's not an overt statement of it. It's more subtle than that. But it is what it amounts to. At the end of the day, if a person says to God, why does everybody else, you know, have this and I don't, it amounts to a statement of, God, what you're doing is not just, because I should have what everybody else does. So going back to the first question, am I supposed to view Ayin Hara as something serious, something real, something substantive? So the answer seems to be yes. If you take a look at source number one, this is a comment by Ramban Nachmanides writing in the 13th century regarding a serious legal topic called Hezek Re'iyah. This is a dry topic of law. It's about as dry as you can get. It's the issue of zoning laws. The Gemara in Bava Basra is filled with zoning laws. Everything from if there's a wall between my property and that of my neighbor, so how close to the wall may I dig a pit? May I do laundry? All sorts of things that might end up damaging the ground at the base of the wall. Issues of neighborly behavior, loud noise within my property, for example, drilling within my property. What do I do if my neighbor has birds in a nest in his yard and they fly into my yard? All sorts of property sharing relationship issues that we generally like to avoid if we can. Not that we want to avoid learning about it, we want to avoid entering into those issues in practice. So there, the Gemara discusses what's called Hezek Re'iyah. Hezek Re'iyah literally is what? How would you translate Hezek Re'iyah? Hezek is like the word Nezek, which means damage, right? Re'iyah is?
Sight.
Seeing, right. Hezek Re'iyah is damage caused by seeing. And the issue is a common one, frankly, here. You know, the way that Thornhill is designed is designed to avoid Hezek Re'iyah problems, even though we're in what is really Hezek Re'iyah territory. Hezek Re'iyah, damage by sight, in its most basic form, is that I'm not supposed to build my house in such a way that I can see from my house into somebody else's property. So with everybody here on the zero property line construction, you'd think that everybody would be seeing into each other's property, but the way that it's designed is that the windows of one house are opposite, you know, a brick wall of the next house, at least on York Hill, where I am. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Right, so Elena asks, is this, you know, is this an issue of tzniut? In part it is. When Bilam says of the Jews, Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov, how good are your tents, Yaakov? So the Medrash there comments that the way that they were situated was such that you couldn't look from one person's house into another person's house. The wall, the windows, the doors, they're all not aligned, in order to make sure that one person won't see into someone else's property. And from a certain perspective, yes, it's a matter of snoot. However, the Gemara also uses a stronger term, and a broader term, called hezek ri'ia, that it's damage caused by sight. And take a look, please, at source number one, and you will see what Ramban says is the meaning of hezek ri'ia. He says, behezek ri'ia dinizke adam ba'adam hu. He says, hezek ri'ia, damage by sight, is harm of one person by another. Imishum ayin ra'a, could be because of evil eye. Imishum lishnabisha, it could be because of harmful speech. Lishnabisha is the Aramaic of lashon hara. Bish is ra in Aramaic. So, harmful speech, meaning you see what's going on in somebody else's property, and then you have what to talk about, so to speak. So the idea that you're going to go tell people what you saw in their yard. Imishum snusa, or simply because of privacy. The issue of, I don't want them seeing, you know, what I'm doing. They're not supposed to see what I'm doing. So Ramban says that one of the guiding principles of our zoning laws, this principle of avoiding someone seeing into somebody else's property, is partly an issue of evil eye. I don't want them having an evil eye on what I am doing within my yard. So it's as dry can be within halacha, you know, the zoning laws, but part of it is predicated on this assumption that people looking into my property can engage in some kind of harm. Now, you could argue that this is really about personal preference rather than substance. In other words, it could be evil eye is meaningless, but since I don't want someone looking at my property because I believe they will be harming it by looking at it, therefore they can't build their property in such a way that they can see it. You follow? It may be about personal sensitivities and not that evil eye is actually effective. However, take a look at source number two, where you'll find something a little more clear-cut. The Shulchan Aruch discusses the laws of Aliyot, calling people up to the Torah. And you may have heard of this. It's fairly common. The Shulchan Aruch writes, Yecholam likros beiz achim ze achar ze. One may call two brothers, or a father and son, consecutively, right? Ben achar ha'av in the Hebrew. You could call two brothers up to the Torah one after the other. You can call up a father and son one after the other. However, ve'ein manichim, we don't permit it. Why? Bishvil ayin hara. Because of concern for the evil eye. So we aren't going to allow we are not going to allow father and son to be called up one after the other. We're not going to allow two brothers to be called up after the other, one after the other. What's the evil eye concern here?
Too much honor for one family?
Yeah. It's the issue of family getting honored this way in public.
What's the difference if it's one after the other or one separated by a little, you're still getting honor to that same family.
Right. I think it's less obvious to people, less visible to people when you have both of them standing up there. It's more evident. I also wonder if it isn't not just the honor of getting the aliyah, but just putting them on public display like that. I once was at a wedding where Kanaina Hara, between the two sides of the family, the chassan and the kala, the groom and the bride, had seven male siblings. And they gave sheva brachos to each other. So notice they call up this one brother of the chassan, this one brother of the kala, this one brother of the chassan, this one brother of the kala. And on the one hand, I thought, wow, that's beautiful. You know, that they have all of these, you know, brothers who can get up and do this. And it was nice. On the other hand, I'm thinking, wow, that's Einar. You think about people who are sitting there who aren't blessed with families like that, and who feel their misfortune, you know, as someone else's good fortune. Now, how far do you take that then? So does that mean that we never have anything public because people are going to see, people are going to feel bad? Yeah, that's a good question. But here we're seeing an issue of substance. Alyssa.
Wait, so are we saying that it's mostly that other people will see and they're going to say something negative, or it's something Hashem's going to see, so to speak, and Hashem's going to see all this public honor given to this family?
What does it sound like?
It sounds like it's what other people are going to say based on this example also. That
right. It sounds to me like it's about the other people. It's not about Hashem at all. Now, we have separate issues of things like arrogance, right? But yes, evil eye is not an evil eye attributed to God. It's an evil eye attributed to other people. Yes?
Isn't it slightly disrespectful to other people to assume that just because they don't have something that you have, that they will feel that way? Because if we respect others, we wouldn't think they would feel that way. I know. You know, that's how I feel often.
Someone asked me,
you have of someone or people in general. Or
right. Someone asked me a similar question.
So beautiful. They're so lucky, but in a nice way, right?
Right. Right. Someone asked me a similar question a few weeks ago about Maris Ayin, right? The issue of appearances, where we say that halachically I'm not allowed to engage in activity which someone might perceive and think is inappropriate. Right, so the classic example was always the Shabbos clock turning on the light in your house on Shabbos. Well, is someone, you know, walking by going to think that you turned on a light? Or the non-dairy creamer that really is parv, and you know, you put it in your coffee that you have with the meat meal, and someone's going to see it and think that you're using milk. The question is, well, people are supposed to be done the kaf zechus. They're supposed to judge others favorably. So why should I suspect that people are going to think something inappropriate about my conduct? So there is such an argument. But the response is, at least from my perspective, that if 100 people see it, yes, there may well be one who is going to have that reaction. It doesn't have to be everybody having that reaction. You know, they are responsible to go back to, you know, in my case, they are responsible to be tamla kafsechus, to judge me favorably, but I am responsible to the Torah's mandate of v'yisem nikiyim, that you shall be innocent in the eyes of others. And in this case, they are responsible not to burn at my success, but I am responsible not to put it in their face. Yeah, I think that the two do go hand in hand. You know, I mean, there does have to be a healthy boundary. I would agree. That doesn't mean that we now should all walk around in torn clothing and whatever, so lest anybody think that things are good. But within reason, for us to try to avoid this, it seems to be the imperative. We'll see how far we go, but that's the idea. Yeah.
I have just a question. Maybe it's a little bit off topic, but sometimes even the statement could be made by you. My own experience, you can put it in the lie, you can say something for your own child. It's not like you wish something unfortunate to happen.
Oh, yeah.
But you're stating the fact, like, as with my mother, will walk behind our children, we have children close in age, and say, isn't it wonderful they weren't sick, like, for a while? Next thing, it's not like I wish, you know.
Yeah. So, frankly, we also, the human mind is remarkably flexible, and we tend to find patterns even when there are none. I remember that before my brother's child's bris, the Friday night before it, in some dream, I had a dream that they had named the baby such and such. And it turned out to be, it was almost the same name. It was the same two names, but reversed. And I thought, wow, isn't that weird? But the truth of the matter is, how many times have I dreamed something, and then it didn't come true, and I forgot about it? You know, you have certain thoughts in your head, and then, they come true, they don't come true. We tend to find patterns and recognize things where there may be none, and that may augment our sort of sense of, wow, she said they haven't been sick in a while, and then the next day they got strep. It does come into play with this, because it is something that we...
It wasn't like, sometimes evil eye, it looks like a person sitting and said, I wish they wouldn't have this family. But it's a tinge inside of something, of jealousy. you just, you know, isn't it incredible, the seven sons, you know, and you have none?
Right.
And there is a something...
Right, no, I think the jealousy bit, you know, not on the illness case that you mentioned, but in general, the jealousy, I think jealousy is real.
Even though they would say it, I wish they wouldn't have it, but
right.
There's something...
Right, and there is another piece to it, which I think we did mention a little bit last time, which is when you cause somebody else to suffer, they cry out to God. Not they cry out to God as in, you know, punish so-and-so, but they cry out to God in their own pain. That in and of itself is, so to speak, actionable. That in and of itself is chet. And then you get into where Hashem could then become an agent, so to speak. Why did you cause somebody else to feel suffering? So that could certainly be an issue. Our record within halacha is to have sort of a respect for these things, even when we don't understand them. And that goes beyond ayin hara, to lump together some things that maybe shouldn't be lumped together, but I'm going to, in any case, which is sort of these quasi-superstitious ideas where you have some kind of grounding that sort of fits it into Judaism, but it's not quite a really well anchored. Take a look at what I mean in source number 3. The Gemara in Psachim talks about something called zugos. What are zugot? Pairs, right. The Gemara there talks about not doing things in pairs, such as you sit down to drink, so you shouldn't have two cups of wine. If you're going to have two, you should have a third. To have an odd number instead of an even number. And they talk about that in terms of the four cups at the Seder, and well, that's okay because it's for a mitzvah, all sorts of reasons why that's all right. But it's a bizarre concept. It's not one that you're going to find anchored in Psukim and Tanakh. But the Gemara does mention it, and here's the concluding line for that discussion in source number 3. Klala de Milsa, as a general rule, called the kapid, kapdi bahadei, one who is precise in it, meaning one who's like careful, like I'm not going to have an even number, right, will be treated precisely. So then whatever it is, if he does foul it up, he's going to get zapped. Whereas, d'lo kapid, lo kapdi bahadei, one who is imprecise in it will be treated imprecisely, meaning if you don't bother with these things, they won't bother with you. You leave them alone, you do what you do, don't start messing around with the rules of magic, whatever it is, and nothing's going to happen to you. However, but after having just basically discredited it, having just said, well, if you're careful about this, then you could get zapped, but if you ignore it, it'll leave you alone. Having just said that, and I would have been very comfortable stopping there and saying, okay, it'll leave you alone. It says, but one should be careful. All the same, don't simply flout these practices. And some of them are very odd practices. It's definitely in the stranger realm. We'll talk about where that comes from in a little bit. But I want to show you a progression now. Take a look at Rabbi Ovadia Yosef in a contemporary responsum on the issue of two brothers who marry two sisters. Within halacha, there's nothing wrong with two brothers marrying two sisters. The only concern that theoretically might be would be that if one of the brothers, God forbid, were to pass away without a child, then the other brother could not do yibum because it's his wife's sister. So that's true. But that's not a halachic reason not to be able to do it. And in fact, Jews have done it. Two brothers marrying two sisters has happened. However, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, writing in the 13th century, writes his tzava, his instructions for his children. He also writes a work called Sefer Chassidim. And he includes in this that two brothers should not marry two sisters. And the question is, well, why? Halachically, it's fine to do. He has a few things like that. You've heard of the practice of not marrying someone who has the same name as your parents?
Yeah.
So that's from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid also.
Do we hold it back? Because I was told not.
Right, so that's a good question. Do we hold of it or not?
Superstition.
Not to marry. In other words, I shouldn't marry a woman whose name is the same as my mother's name.
It was okay. So
my mother-in-law had a thing about that because she's Chana Pearl and I'm Rebecca Chana, and she had this. Well, we have the same name, you know, and it was like
I think before she was founded on, you know,
like she had no.
I was supposed to respect. Respect, because before your mother and your wife is the mother. That's always the wife. Your mother is the mother. I was as a child, I was told it's okay.
Right. So there are a few different explanations for it because we do find it classically. It's not like this is something that was never done among Jews. So one explanation is that it was a concern for respect, exactly when you use the name. Another similar explanation was that it was about confusion. Because remember that people would often live in the same house or even just, you know, in the same little area. And, you know, you call your wife and your mother thinks that you're talking to her or whatever it is. That can be uncomfortable. So
nobody calls their mother by their first name. We call mother, mommy, or whatever.
Right. So it doesn't have to be you. Someone else is speaking to them. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be from you, but that's true. And then others said that this was something that Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid felt was really important for his descendants. Somehow he knew mystically that it would matter for his descendants, and therefore he was just saying it for them, that they shouldn't do this. So similarly, he has this line about two brothers not marrying two sisters. So take a look at how Rav Avadia Yosef deals with it in his tshuva, in his responsum. He says, "B'nogei lebeiz ach marotzim lisa beiz achios," regarding two brothers who wish to wed two sisters. So he says, "B'noda v'Yehuda challenged it." Note of Yehuda, Rabbi Chezka Landau, I believe was his last name, writing in the 18th century. So he challenged this statement because the Gemara includes such cases in which, in fact, two brothers marry two sisters. All of Yavamos is filled with that. So he contended, the Note of Yehuda contended, that Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid only meant to instruct his descendants. It wasn't meant to be a global statement, this is prohibited. My family shouldn't do this, for whatever reason. However, he continues, the Chida, Rechaim Yosef David Azulai, who he's remarkable and very worth knowing about in general. He was, I think, from Turkey originally, Sephardi, and he wrote on pretty much every area of Torah, including numerous books of tshuvos, of responsa, that are halachic in the extreme, and works of Kabbalah as well. He also wrote the Birka Yosef commentary to the Shulchan Aruch. Really prolific. So the Chida is an expert in both halacha and the mystical. And so he says, the Chida answered, there is a difference between then, meaning the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, and now, meaning when the Chida is writing, I think, is 18th century. Because, number one, the forces of the evil eye are stronger to, I'm sorry, not then and now, meaning that, then meaning the Gemara's time, when in the Gemara they had no problem with two brothers marrying two sisters, and now, meaning the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid in the 13th century. Because, number one, the forces of the evil eye are stronger today. So in other words, two brothers marrying two sisters is somehow an Ayin Hara issue. How, he doesn't explain. But he says, the Gemara said they could marry, because in the Gemara's day, evil eyes wasn't a strong thing. But the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid already was something to avoid. And number two, people don't normally marry thus today, and so there is concern for the evil eye. Things that stand out, as we'll see more today, I hope, things that stand out are more vulnerable to the evil eye. Therefore, there's greater concern when two brothers marry two sisters nowadays, because it's less common. In the days of the Gemara, people married within families all the time. It was done economically. So, for example, if a man had a niece who was unable to get married, he would often be encouraged within the family to marry her so that she will have someone to support her. What changed between the time of the Gemara and the 12th century? Sorry?
Can't marry two women.
Right, the ban on polygamy. So it wasn't as simple as saying, well, I could support her so she'll become a member of my household also. It didn't work that way. That's the major driver that changes that. But his point is, since it's uncommon for two brothers to marry two sisters, I think that it's an evil eye concern. That's the Chida's statement. So Rav Avadia Yosef comes along and says, you know, one could argue his first point about the evil eye being stronger today. For it is known that many issues of the evil eye are not found today. Many of the concerns that we have, don't do this, it's going to cause harm. No one knows why that should cause harm anymore. No one observes it causing harm anymore. Perhaps our generation is better in this regard. The other side, by which he means the harmful force, Sitra Achra is the classic term in Aramaic, is nourished by forces of sanctity. So that, in the days of our ancestors' sanctity, this force was stronger. It appears that one should be concerned where people are customarily cautious. So Avadia Yosef suggests that maybe the evil eye is not as strong now as it once was. It's nourished by forces of Kedusha, of holiness. What in the world does that mean? Yeah, so I could give all sorts of theories. Probably if I wasn't being recorded, I would. But I'm going to leave the line as is right now. But the idea is that he says nowadays evil eye simply isn't the force it once was. Nowadays, and therefore, I shouldn't be concerned about the evil eye the way that they were concerned, the way that Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid was concerned. It shouldn't really bother me. And he says this as though, you know, this is, you know, a serious, significant, practical concept that we should say that nowadays it's not as big a concern. And I would have expected his concluding line, therefore, to be, so go ahead, right, let them marry. But his concluding line is, you know what, in places where people are cautious about this, you should be cautious too, don't do it. We don't want to break with the practice. Similarly, when it comes to the classic red bendel, right, the red string, where you talk about, you know, tying the red string in order to gain protection. We're going to see in source number 7, we're not there yet, that that practice may not be a Jewish practice at all. It may actually be a pagan practice. But take a look at what our Moshe Stern, the Deborah Tziner of, wrote about tying on the red string. He's following up on two previous questions that he had also about similar types of practices. And this is what he says about the red string. He says, Sheila, the question he's asked. Im yesh makor leminhag likshor chutshani mipnei ayin hara al hatinok ba'agalato kayotze ba'u. Is there a source for tying a red string on a child, carriage, and so on because of the evil eye? And he says, Heishanti, I answered, Kein haya haminog va'kol asu kein. That was the custom. Everybody did it. Or as I put it more briefly in the translation, that was the universal practice. They were careful to tie a red string on a carriage and crib of a child because of the evil eye. All of these are the practices of elderly women, he says. Which, when he says that, what does that make you think? Baba Maisa, no? But he's not. He means it seriously. He says, these are the practices of elderly women, regarding which the Rashba wrote that we should not mock their words and practices, for they are certainly founded in the sacred mountains, meaning the Torah, even if we do not know the reasons. The response of the Rashba is on a separate issue entirely. The response of the Rashba is on different types of minhag, where customs come from. And I gave you in the Hebrew, I gave you the reference to his responsum. But one of the types of minhag that he mentions is minhagim that were passed down by women of this is the way our family does things. And he says, you take it seriously. You follow those, you follow those even though they're not anchored in any text you're aware of. So the sense of Ramosha Stern is, I can't tell you why anyone's tying any red strings on things. But there must be a reason for it, so keep on doing it. Now, he's the Deborah Tziner. Deborah Tziner was, Deborah Tziner Hasidim are Hungarian. That's important to keep in mind, because that's where the red string is, I think, strongest culturally, is among Hungarian Jews. So this shouldn't be such a surprise.
It's a very big thing.
Well, it's I'm wondering how it got there.
So popular.
Yeah. No, it definitely was not always so popular.
The last 20, 25 years?
Yeah. I think that's definitely I remember going, going 25 years ago to the Kotel and not seeing anything like that. And in the last 15 years, you can't go without bumping into people.
Yeah, they come. Yeah,
I think they grab you.
My only reference was my Hungarian aunt to a red bendel.
Yeah.
If I'm in Russia, they would say put red string if you have a problem with your wrist.
Really? Carpal tunnel.
But it's a Russian thing.
Interesting.
The Russian thing has a funny thing, and I realized only when I started learning. For example, they say it's a bad omen to pass something through the door.
Mm-hmm.
Because they probably saw a Jew.
My Russian neighbors told me that.
Yeah, probably.
Yes, she made me walk in the house. I was going to hand it to her at the door. I'm sorry, please, would you just come inside?
They saw Jews doing it on Shabbos or Chagim, you know, the public property and whatever, because Jews know something.
Yeah.
The Russians just do this because Jews.
But if that was an issue, you couldn't walk inside with it either.
Yeah,
you can't
with it.
Can't
carry it.
This,
I would have the same problem. If you, for example, somebody bringing something from the public domain. And
yeah, but then they couldn't have. If Jews were really being careful about it, then they wouldn't have been carrying it.
Inside out.
From the inside to the outside, but then
you
leave with it. Who knows? Could be.
But I have a question.
Yeah.
What if the source was rooted in nourishing. Mm-hmm. Is it still something that we need to maintain?
Right.
Just because we've done it so many
right.
times.
Right. So hang on to that question. I wanted to add one more point on the red bendel. There is the theoretical possibility that it goes back to the story of Peretz and Zerach, which you'll see not in this coming Shabbos' parasha, but the following week, when Yehuda and Tamar have their twins, Peretz and Zerah, and the first one comes out, and they tie, Batik Shoal Yado Shani, they tie a red string on his arm, saying, Zeh Yatzah Rishonah, this one came out first. Now, it seems to just be a marker that this one is first. Similarly, when you had Bikurim, the farmer would take the first fruits, he would identify the first fruits, we're told, by tying a red string on them. So you could argue that it comes from there. It doesn't have to be a pagan practice or whatever. At the same time, it does seem to be, Narishkeit. So I think that gets us to our next point. My first point was I wanted to show that we do have a history of taking these concerns seriously, even without understanding where they come from. And I think the reason why we do take them seriously, even where we don't know where they're coming from, is because of a feeling of, what's it going to cost me to take this seriously? What's the big deal if I don't pass things through a door? Does it hurt me? No, so they come inside instead. What's the big deal? And it might actually help. This overall sense of powerlessness within the universe, like, I don't know why things happen, and I have no control over why things happen, so maybe if I just do this, then I'll be okay, is a strong motivation for people to do this. You think of baseball players who won't change their socks when they're on a winning streak. There isn't a high enough price in doing so, apparently. So they just, they'll just keep on doing it. And you'll tell them, but that's absurd. That has nothing to do with the way you play. And their answer is, fine, but I'm still not changing my socks. It's what's the big deal if I do this or if I don't do that? Where halacha sort of puts a stop to it, though, is where the treatment becomes dangerous. Where the anti-ayin hara practices run the risk of actually leading away from Judaism. And that's where we get into interesting territory. Yeah.
Like weird things we're doing.
Well, weird things for sure. But take a look at source number 6. The Rambam, remember, believes that one of the most destructive forces in the universe is foolishness. For the Rambam, everything is about intellect. So take a look at what he has to say in source number 6 in his Mora HaNevuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed. The Hebrew is on one side, the English is on the other. He says, he's talking about various practices which people have. And he says, Nichtivu ha-kizav ma-heim asher b'dom ha-psoim ha-rishonim. He says, these lies, these falsehoods were created by early fools, but they were recorded. And the books were brought to good people of soft spirit, fools who lacked a scale with which to know truth from falsehood. They hid these books, because who knew where they were from or what their story was, which were found in their estates, and people thought them to be true. I discovered a book of such and such. It says, do this or don't do that. And people thought them to be true. In the end, a fool will believe everything. That's the Rambam's phrase in the Hebrew, v'sof davar pesiyam in l'chol davar. The fool's going to believe whatever you tell him. That's also the Rambam's theory on Avodah Zarah, on idolatry, is that these were ideas that were crafted by people who took advantage of patterns they noticed in nature to pretend that they could predict things. And then they told people, now go do this or go do that, maliciously, for their own gain. They told people what they should do, and then those practices just became rote. Like, this is what we do, outliving the original people who were benefiting therefrom, and it just became religion. So the Rambam says, the whole thing is foolishness, and he's not terribly happy about it. What he's talking about in context is about different ways of using supposed names of Hashem in order to perform mystical feats. He can't disagree that there is such a thing, because the Gemara talks about it. But he says, what I'm seeing is a joke. He says people have taken advantage of this, they've written up weird ideas, and the Rambam is bothered by it being foolishness. Others have more, if you will, substantive concerns. In other words, from my perspective, if someone does something and it's foolish, Okay, so we shouldn't be wasting his time on it, but is that really destructive? You know, people do all sorts of foolish things. So if someone is willing to, I don't know, I'm not endorsing this in any way, shape, or form. If someone is willing to spend 30 minutes watching a sitcom on television, so what's the big deal if they also stick a red string on their wrist? One is just as foolish as the other. One is as big a waste as the other. So if it makes them happy to tie a red string on their wrist, you know, well, fine. Right, one takes 30 minutes to do and one takes 5 seconds. Well put. There are more grave concerns. Rav Haigon, writing in on the Gemara in Chagig, well, it's recorded in the Otzer Hagaonim to the Gemara in Chagiga, it's Daf Yadalet. I didn't end up bringing it here on the sheet. But Rav Haigon there said, and Rav Haigon, remember, is one of the last of the Gaonim, after the period of the Gemara, you have a slim period historically called the Savarayim, and then after that you have the rise of Babylonian yeshivot, whose heads were each called Gaon. Gaon did not mean genius in those days. Gaon meant person of power. It came to mean genius because the head of the school was called the Gaon, so gradually that meant, oh, must be a genius. But Gaon meant person of Gaava, not Gaava in a bad way, like arrogance, but Gaava meaning power and might. So the head of each yeshiva in Bavel was called the Gaon. Then there was a yeshiva in Kairouan in North Africa, and there was a Gaon at one point in Israel too. But one of the last of the Gaonim was Rav Hai Gaon. He lived in the 10th century. And he said, you find a marked difference in Sfarim going back to the Gemara. You find a marked difference between the attitude of the Jews who live in Israel under the Romans and the attitude of Jews who live under the Persians. By the Persians, he means those who followed in their footsteps also long after the Persian Empire ceased to exist. Because in Israel, where the Yerushalmi is put together, they don't live among cultures that have a lot of these superstitions, which is his term. Whereas in Bavel, they do. And you find that in Bavel, there's a much greater propensity to record these types of evil eye practices. And he's basically saying it's being absorbed from the culture around us. It's not Jewish. It's not actually ours. It's something that crept in from society around us. Now, if Haigon is willing to say that, going back to the times of the Gemara, it is all the more applicable for Jews who lived in Eastern Europe over the last 500 years. Among neighbors who were doing all of these various things. Or Jews who lived in Arabic cultures where they may have had, you know, practices of their own. The Khamsa is always, you know, a popular example. Take a look at source number 7, where you find the red string discussed. Hakosher chut, in some editions, and you have the word al-gabe after that. Hakosher chut adom. Rabbi Gamliel Omer Eino Midarkeho Emori, Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Tzadok Omer Hareza Midarkeho Emori. One who ties a red string, or alternate edition, one who ties a string on a red mark. So that may be something very different. But there's a debate whether this is what's called Darkei Emori. Darkei Emori literally means practices of the Canaanite nations the Jews encountered when they entered Israel. What it means halachically is a prohibited practice. Darkei Emori are prohibited. The Torah says, "Uvuchukoseihem lo seilechu," you shall not imitate those nations you are going to encounter. And the concern is for idolatrous practices. That's what we're fundamentally worried about. Take a look at source number 8, where the Rambam discusses in his Mora HaNevuchim these practices of the nations. He says, "Chukos hagoyim kulam asher hayu choshvim shem kochos usgulos." The practices of the nations, which they considered forces and sigulot, literally a sigula is like a treasure, the forces of special potency. Even practices which lack a scent of idolatry are prohibited. The Torah prohibited all of their practices, which are titled Amorite practices, which came to them from idolatry. So the Rambam's concern, and he's not the only one to mention it, is that things that creep in from the nations may well be idolatrous in origin and are to be avoided. So we've gone from talking about practices which may be value neutral and are at worst a waste of time, to practices which may come from idol worship and may potentially lure somebody out even in that direction. Because how far is it for somebody, I'm now going to make up a practice, okay? I don't think anyone's ever had the superstition. I don't want to start it. But let's say someone had the practice that before they walk into their house, they take off their shoes, not, where do you think I'll go with? They not a Canadian thing. Before they walk into a house, they take off their shoes and they put them on top of the lintel outside the front door. That's their practice. Why? Someone in my family started doing it at some point. Then they discover that there's some population of people living somewhere in Yellowknife that actually does this. And then they start to learn about the other practices of these people from Yellowknife. There's a closeness that you start to perceive, because I do this and they do this, and who knows what it can lead a person to adopt and where it can take things. So I don't think that last point is what the Rambam is saying. I think the Rambam is simply saying, in and of itself, the practice should be rejected because it comes from idolatry. But I wonder about this additional concern about what it can lead a person to adopt once he starts to see associations between that practice and other things that other people do. Yeah.
It's not like the concept of Ayin Hara has its basis in Torah, but all the practices surrounding them do not.
The word all is a loaded word, but I think a lot of
it. At best it's silly, and at worst it has a metaphorical
But then I have also the sort of more grounded ones, like don't look into somebody else's property where they're doing their stuff. Don't build your house so you can look from your window into their yard. Or don't don't call up people for an aliyah, don't call up the brothers sequentially, which I can perceive. Right, I can perceive a logic to it, which I can't in terms of a red string. So that's true. Yeah.
If we consider evil eye existing, the energy exists, who knows that energy exists? There is somebody who observed the experiment, effects experiment by virtue of observing.
Okay.
There is a certain. It means that something could be done to counter the factor.
Right.
And the red string sounds funny, or doing a necrovasa sounds reasonable.
Right. And that's what I wanted to actually... I think I'm going to hold that for next time. But the whole issue of belief in the supernatural is not something you can throw out the window because people have strange practices. So that's something that has to come in next time. I think there are three things I have to leave next time. Number one is that not all of these segulot or anti-Ayin Hara practices are coming from idolatrous areas, and therefore we need to look more carefully at that. Think of the challah baking practice, for example, right? The 40 challah bakers, right? I get nonstop emails about it, but I don't think it counts when you just bake off like the Lynchner's challah. All right, next time. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about belief in the supernatural, just as a general point, and then still deal with what is recommended within the Gemara for avoiding Ayin Hara. So we have a lot still to cover within this. I thought we'd finish it today, but ain't no way.
But the fact that the red string is being mentioned,